Welcome to the Dispatch Podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Isger, joined by Steve Hayes. And this week, we are talking to Congressman Mike Gallagher. He represents Wisconsin's 8th District in Congress. By the way, he's a 7th generation Wisconsin native, so no question about how he got on this podcast, Steve. But Congressman Gallagher is a former Marine. He did intel in Iraq, was deployed several times. Absolutely has thoughts on what is going on in Afghanistan. Let's dive right in. Congressman, we are mourning for our service members today. And there has been so much that has led up to that moment. And plenty of second guessing and things we should have done differently. But starting from today, what should the administration do moving forward?
Well, it's hard to set aside what happened. I mean, I think every Marine is grieving for the loss of 12 Marines and one corpsman. It will go down as one of the darkest days in Marine Corps history. You know, one is reminded of Beirut, Mayaguez, things like that. And so just a real gut punch. Your heart goes out to the families and, you know, the wives and the mothers and sisters and everyone who's anxiously waiting to hear from their loved ones who were deployed downrange. So very sad day, very tragic. Where do we go from here? I have encouraged the Biden administration, not only rhetorically, but through legislation, to abandon the arbitrary August 31st deadline. I guess I shouldn't call it arbitrary. My assumption is it has to do with September 11th, 2021 being the Biden's preferred date to get out of the country. And then you do some backwards planning, and August 31st is the timeline that is necessary. And the Taliban are now exploiting that and have threatened us by saying, if you're there a second later than midnight, August 31st, we're going to do some bad stuff. And it wasn't just me encouraging them to abandon that date. At least in behind closed doors in classified sessions, there was a group of bipartisan legislators and some Democrats, particularly Democrats who'd served in Afghanistan, who were very, very critical of the administration. I know Democrats who were in the Oval Office this week urging the president to abandon that timeline, at least commit to staying until we get every American that wants to get out. And I think that's the only thing we can do right now. I'm not deluding myself that, you know, we're going to reverse the broader decision to get out, that we're suddenly going to realize that it'd be nice to have Bagram, not just as a counterterrorism base, but as an asset in the long-term competition with China and as a way to threaten their space and counterspace assets on their western flank. But at a minimum, I do believe there's more we can do to get all of our people out and get our Afghan allies out. And I think this idea that we're somehow going to rely on the interest of the Taliban in order to build a post-August 31st bridge, as one defense official described it to me, for those Afghan allies that we know we're not going to be able to get out, is a total fantasy. And I'm fascinated by the language the Biden administration keeps deploying about the Taliban's interests. And I think the president talked about it yesterday, right? It's in the Taliban's interests to, I forget exactly what he said, but basically be a security partner with us and help us get our people out. I don't think the Biden administration in general and the president in particular has any freaking clue what's in the Taliban's interests, right? I mean, I guess the Taliban, yes, has an interest in us getting out. I understand that. But this argument they're making that because the Taliban wants humanitarian assistance post August 31st, wants a functioning international airport post August 31st, means that we somehow will have leverage because the Taliban is this rational actor sitting back and calculating their economic utility, I think is a total naive fantasy and represents like the worst of political science grafted on to the complexities of war. What's in the Taliban's interest, since we've surrendered, is to make that surrender as humiliating and painful as possible. And then more to the point, the Taliban's not a monolithic entity, right? All it takes is one stupid person, you know, taking Americans hostage, which I have reason to believe Americans have already been taken hostage. And I think that the problem is going to get worse post August 31st to start to really mess up your neat and tidy theories about the Taliban acting in the way a Davos attendee would act, right? So I don't know. The whole thing is a mess. And there are very few options we have right now. And so all we can do is just get our people out and not leave anybody behind.
Steve?
Let me pick up on that, because I think it's really one of the sort of key failings of U.S. policy in Afghanistan over the past three administrations, really. And that is this desire to see the Taliban as something the Taliban is not. It started with the Obama administration, where we had negotiations with the Taliban as if they would be partners in peace. You saw it with the Trump administration, when you had senior Trump administration officials, including the president, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, insist that the Taliban would be America's counterterrorism partner in Afghanistan, fighting al-Qaeda and others. And now you're seeing this from the Biden administration at sort of a greater scale. What's the thinking behind this? I mean, you spent a lot of time thinking about foreign policy. You understand kind of the complexities here. What's the charitable understanding of that?
The charitable understanding. Well, listen, I think the honest argument that the Biden administration thus far does not want to make, although I think it's sort of what Biden's getting at with this, hey, this was always going to happen stuff he's been saying, is someone had to rip off the Band-Aid. It was always going to be painful. We're ripping off the Band-Aid. And then lying behind that honest argument is a cynical argument that perhaps Ron Klain is making to Biden, which is, this is going to be a bad news cycle. We'll manage it, and then it will blow over. And that's all it is. And then a month from now, no one will care about Afghanistan. But more directly to answer your question, there seems to be another talking point that I've just detected coming from all these Biden people, which is, you've heard a few of them say, whenever they say the Taliban, whenever they say ISIS-K, ISIS Khorasan, they'll say, which is the sworn enemy of the Taliban, right?
Yeah.
And this reminds me of kind of the argument that was made to justify the pullout of Iraq, and also by extension to justify the pullout or the rapprochement with Iran, which was a suggestion that, okay, we didn't really need to worry about like the role Shia militias were playing in Iraq because they're fighting ISIS. And this is sort of the Sarah Palin, let Allah sort them out argument, right? It's these groups hate each other, right? ISIS defected from al-Qaeda and they're now sworn enemies. So of course we can just let them kill each other and that's all going to work out. Well, that doesn't work, right? Because when Salafi jihadists fight each other, they start to attract a bunch of Salafi jihadists to that fight. And the people that tend to get killed are not just crazy Salafi jihadists. It's a lot of civilians and a lot of our allies that are stuck in the middle. I it's too early to tell, but I think there's like a similar thing going on here where they're starting to suggest that, okay, the Taliban, you know, we can't trust them, but we have mutual interests. They're going to kill ISIS-K guys. And really all we care about is al-Qaeda and ISIS-K. So there's a workable framework here. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. But I would suggest it's even worse than your depiction makes it look, because we're actively taking sides in this scenario. So it's not just like, let them kill themselves and sort it out, which would be kind of the logical end of the non-interventionist argument, right? Like, it's not our business, it's hands off, they figure it out. In this case, what we're saying is, no, we are taking a side. And our side is the side of the Taliban. And, you know, the deputy leader of the Taliban, yes, he's Siraj Akhani. Yes, we have $10 million bounty on his head. Yes, he's long been involved with al-Qaeda. Yes, the Haqqani network has killed Americans, actively fought Americans for two decades in Afghanistan. But they could be useful to us right now. I mean, I guess I want to go beyond just criticizing, because obviously this is something that gets me very fired up. But I'd like to try to understand the logic. I mean, I really would like to understand what is the case there. Like, what do they think is likely to happen by teaming up with or pretending to partner with the group that harbored al-Qaeda and prepared the ground for the 9/11 attacks?
Well, are they going to be the ones providing us, given that our intelligence collection capabilities will be severely impacted by this pullout, right? I mean, the CIA needs support to collect human intelligence. Yes. There are limits even via SIGINT to what you can collect. Are they going to be providing us the intel that's going to be driving our targeting? That's the other thing I've never in the past 6 months heard anybody explain to me. And I'm open to entertaining the most charitable version of this argument. If we're doing over the horizon counterterrorism, how does that work? How do you generate the intel?
If you don't
how do you get over the impossible geography that Afghanistan presents? Our drones can't fly forever. They need fuel to fly. Particularly since Putin said, hell no, I'm not going to allow you to establish alternative bases in some of the other stands. Another humiliation for America in this mess. How does it work? I'm open to the idea. If we can do it over the horizon, that'd be great. I just don't think it's possible as a matter of geography and math. And as an intel guy, I mean, it's just a fantasy to think you're going to have these beautiful target sets appear without the ability to collect intelligence on the ground. You know, the other thing I find fascinating, I'm sorry to go on, because these are all just, I mean, listen, we all got arguments and we need to test these arguments against reality. Okay. Jake Sullivan seems to suggest that don't worry about our commitments in the Indo-Pacific, the real priority theater. They're sacrosanct. The people of Taiwan should not be afraid. Japan, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to have more bandwidth to focus on China, and this won't have a bad reputational effect. Okay, if I grant the idea, and I don't, by the way, that there will be no reputational impact from the pullout in Afghanistan, then I'm putting all my eggs in the basket, and that we really just need to focus on the Indo-Pacific. For that, I'm putting all my eggs in the basket of the balance of power in the Indo-Pacific being favorable to the United States. Mm-hmm. And increasingly, it is less favorable. So even if the pullout in Afghanistan doesn't affect the credibility of our commitments, the fact that we are failing to field conventional assets in the first island chain with the appropriate alacrity that we need to undermines our military deterrence in that region, the so-called priority region, in part because of the Biden administration's defense budget and some of the stupid things it wants to do and some of the nonsense that the Secretary of Defense is talking about with integrated deterrence, which is a buzz phrase to cover up for an unwillingness to invest in conventional hard power. So none of this makes sense to me. Maybe I just don't understand it, but I haven't seen anyone in the Biden administration come up and make a coherent argument.
So what is the role of Congress at this point? You mentioned legislation that you've proposed. We still have the AUMF, the Authorized Use of Military Force, out there. Was Congress going to start flexing a little here? Will it matter after 2022 if Republicans retake the House, or will this be a long memory? What would you say you do here, Congressman?
Office Space explains the world, by the way. Or at least explains
it's
the
good
government.
That he picked up on that. Yeah.
What would you say? Why should I have to change my name? He's the one who sucks.
That is a Michael Bolton reference for those of you who have not seen Office Space.
Check me on this. I believe I once wrote an article about intelligence and counterinsurgency that had Office Space references in it. So I forget where it was. It might have been in the Small Wars Journal when I was a precocious first lieutenant. So the legislation that I had on the floor, which was the previous question to this bigger $5 trillion rule, it's a fancy parliamentary. Basically, the Republicans get one shot to try and, you know, send these Democrat bills back to committee. And the bill, my bill, was that shot. And it basically would have required the administration to do daily reporting to us on the number of Americans left in the country, as well as the number of Afghans seeking refuge, and then would have prevented them from pulling out all troops until we'd gotten all Americans out. Obviously, that raises constitutional questions about the role of Congress, but I'm a Article I conservative. We can get into that if you'd like. So I still think it would be wise for us to reconvene and to try and at least get the administration to be more forthcoming on their efforts to get Americans out of country. Again, I'm increasingly resigned to the fact that Biden is inflexible on the August 31st date, but I still think it's useful for us to push them on just the basic numbers of people that we're leaving behind. After August 31st, I do think we need to demand that they come to us and explain how are we doing counterterrorism in Afghanistan and in Central Asia and throughout the Middle East, and what's it going to require? And if we now have, you know, an immediate $6 billion that we're not going to spend on Afghanistan, how are we best investing that money? As for the AUMF, you know, we did, I think, somewhat productively pass the repeal of the, or in the House at least, repeal of the Iraq AUMF. The 2001 AUMF is a much harder discussion. My view is that it's long past time for us to repeal and replace that AUMF with something that could have no tactical or geographic limits in it, but a five-year sunset, perhaps, that would force Congress to revisit it every 5 years and then have robust reporting requirements in terms of the groups that we're actually targeting. And then there's this question of accountability that we're wrestling with. You know, I do think the administration, people need to be held accountable, whether that's the resignation of the Secretary of State or Defense or National Security Advisor, I don't know. You know, I highly doubt the president himself is going to resign. I'm not sure we'd be trading up by putting Kamala Harris in that role. But someone needs to be held accountable. And Congress, in a democratically controlled House, I would expect to do nothing. But if we retake the House in 2022, I do think we need to do a thorough investigation and hold people accountable for this epic operational failure, this planning failure. I early had called it an intelligence failure. I sort of want to retract that. I'm not exactly sure it was an intelligence failure. One, as an intelligence guy, there are no intelligence successes, only intelligence failures. And I think the intelligence community did warn about the rapidity with which the country could collapse. They had various timelines for that collapse. But I think ultimately it was a leadership failure, starting with the president and then a planning failure that extends to the State Department and DOD. And so I think Congress has a very important role to play in terms of investigating that. And I think all Republicans need to sort of rediscover our traditional arguments for, you know, a conservative internationalist policy. And I think that's a winning issue for us politically as well. The final thing I'd say is on that, you know, I do think the traditional argument is that foreign policy doesn't matter politically. I got it. I understand. But in 2016, at least, I don't think that was the case. You know, as I've told Steve, we may have talked about before, you know, and what I think has very bizarre and tragic echoes to what we're dealing with right now, the threat from ISIS really did affect people in 2016, because it wasn't just a, oh, my gosh, there's a terrorist state carved out in the heart of the Middle East, the size of Indiana. It was a string of terrorist attacks across the world, to include in America. We had domestic terrorism, San Bernardino, but Pulse nightclub had a very immediate political impact because Hillary Clinton canceled her first appearance that she was going to do with Barack Obama on the campaign trail, which is going to be in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And she infamously never came back to Wisconsin because of that attack. And so I think there comes a point at which people sort of feel like the world is getting less safe and it's affecting them domestically, as well as I think a point at which, you know, the humiliation of America on the world stage triggers some Jacksonian impulse. And people, even like more isolationist minded Americans, are like, I don't like that we're getting pushed around. This is just this is not how it should be with America.
So our producer, Ryan Brown, has actually located your article with Office-Based References in Small Wars Journal. We will put that in the show notes.
Sure, it's terrible.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Let me pick up on that point that you are making, though, because the foreign policy positions you outlined for the Republican Party are somewhat at odds with the foreign policy as practiced by the Trump administration. As I said, you had Donald Trump and Mike Pompeo running cover effectively for the Taliban. The roots of the catastrophe that we're seeing now, I mean, we should be very clear. I think Joe Biden and his administration bear the blame for what we're seeing. Full stop. End of discussion. But the roots of this policy, the path, really started in the Obama administration, but the pace accelerated considerably with the horrendous deal that the Trump administration struck in February of 2020 and then sold to the American public. The key sort of plank of that deal being the U.S. is going to work with the Taliban. This is kind of kinder, gentler Taliban. And that was undertaken, in my view, because Donald Trump wanted a less involved America. You know, in that sense, there is a fair amount of continuity between what we're seeing from the Biden administration and the Trump administration. How much do you think you have to sort of wrestle back a traditional Republican foreign policy when the party at large has moved in that Trumpy direction?
You know, my honest answer is I don't know. I think the flaw in the Doha deal, or there are at least two glaring flaws in the Doha deal, right? One was just that the Afghan government really wasn't involved in
deliberately excluded.
Deliberately excluded.
The Taliban, yes.
I still don't know what Zal Khalilzad, what he was doing and what his role was in all of this. And so so that kind of doomed it to failure, as well as you lay out, just this idea that the Taliban was going to be killing Al-Qaeda for us, I think was wrongheaded and deeply flawed. Their counterargument is that it was conditions-based. The Taliban violated the Doha agreement as early as March of 2021, and therefore, had Trump been in a second term, he would have done things differently. I guess being a counterfactual, we'll never know. But the Doha deal was flawed. And I think it gets to this broader issue within the Republican Party, which is that, you know, this sort of this, we need to end endless wars, and that somehow, you know, by precipitously pulling out a couple thousand troops from Afghanistan in order to get that mission accomplished moment, we're somehow going to be setting ourselves up for success geopolitically. I think my own view, both in Afghanistan and in Iraq and Syria, actually, is that we arrived through a very inefficient process of trial and error at a sustainable posture, which is for a very modest and small investment of U.S. resources, largely special operators and largely enablers, right? Working by, with, and through local allies on the ground who are bearing the brunt of the fighting. And we provide intel, we provide logistical support, we provide, you know, air support, et cetera, for a small investment with a light footprint, you can have a huge impact, or at least you can secure very narrowly defined national security objectives. And that, to me, is the best way to avoid a intensely chaotic situation that requires you to divert your attention from more important national security priorities. And I do think China is a much more important national security priority over the long term. So I don't know. I think we got to make the case that, okay, if your view is we're overextended in the Middle East and we really need to invest resources in the Indo-Pacific to focus on China, the best way to do that is to be forward deployed with a small footprint working with local allies and thereby avoid a complete collapse of our position. Avoid what we saw happen in Iraq in the second half of the Obama administration. And then I think, as I alluded to before, I really think we failed to make the case for why Bagram was valuable in the China fight, not just as a counterterrorism base, but as an asset in the long-term fight against China. And then obviously, I think the other controversial aspect of U.S. foreign policy within the Republican Party is the role of allies. And I do think there's a wing that thinks our allies stink and they're more trouble than they're worth. Ironically, this is the view of a lot of progressives as well, particularly when it comes to our Middle East allies. So I think we really need to do a better job of not only talking about the value of our allies, but actually working with our allies to develop common war plans, right? So for example, the debate about NATO is always about our allies don't contribute 2%. They don't meet their 2%. Well, we shouldn't care as much about the inputs as the outputs, right? Like, it doesn't matter as much if Greece is paying 2% of their GDP and contributing that to NATO. It matters more what is Greece going to contribute to the actual mission of deterring Russia by denial. And we don't do that in NATO. We certainly don't do that with our allies in the Indo-Pacific. And to this day, no one in the Pentagon has sat down with me in front of a map and said, okay, when the Taiwan scenario happens, here's what we're doing. Here's what the Aussies are bringing to the fight. Here's what the Japanese are bringing to the fight. Here's what the Taiwanese are capable of right now. That's an area where I think we can actually have a more powerful and practical argument in terms of what our allies contribute to our own defense and to their own defense that we just have failed to do recently, if that makes sense. Sorry, I've only had one cup of coffee. I'm not making a lot of sense.
I want you to tell us where you're going from here. And I'm curious, as you meet our newest countrymen, and I'm so excited to call them that, by the way, these people who have shown such a love of the United States, I'm curious whether you'll be proselytizing the Packers or if you have some other reason for meeting with them.
Well, that's a requirement. Anyone who moves to Wisconsin, even if they're already an American citizen, has to renounce their previous sports allegiances and root for the Packers and chug a lot of beer. It's a weird quirk of our state constitution. So I'm going to Fort McCoy just to see what their process is for dealing with a lot of these Afghan refugees. You know, I think, obviously there's some concern in conservative circles about the vetting requirements and how many people we're letting in. You know, my own view is particularly if you qualify for the SIV program, if you fought with us, you know, we should be doing everything possible to get you out of the country and making sure you're eligible for the SIV program. It has very high level requirements. That's all well and good. And we should have robust vetting procedures, but I'm hoping to, you know, provided we have a good discussion with the military leaders down at Fort McCoy, alleviate some of those concerns with my constituents. And I really do think it will have damaging consequences for our national security and our ability to fight in the future if we abandon our Afghan allies, particularly those who fought with us. And if we turn our back on people who are eligible, in particular for the SIV program. And then for people that aren't eligible for that program, I'm aware of a bunch of private philanthropic efforts underway right now to charter private planes and resettle Afghan women, for example, civil society leaders, journalists in third-party countries, African countries, Serbia, North Macedonia, et cetera, et cetera. But in many cases, they just can't get permission to land. Or state, I've heard, is actively telling people, don't get on airplanes, don't come to the airport. And so these chartered planes land, and maybe three people get out on a plane that could have taken hundreds. That to me is a tragedy. So there's a lot more work that needs to be done in terms of getting our allies out of the country. And then I think alleviating the concerns of a lot of people about our vetting procedures. And so hopefully this is a step in that direction and on my visit today.
Well, as a Texan, please let them know about the great republic to their south. We'd love to have them there. We have some amazing sports teams, including, unfortunately, one that cheated in the World Series not too long ago. So, you know, there's always that.
Well, have you ever read Empire of the Summer Moon?
No.
It is an oh my gosh. It is. I just read this book. It's about Texas. It's about like Texas settlers fighting Comanches. It is so brutal. And it ends up being a story about technology, because the Comanches were kicking our butt because they had better technology. They were better horsemen, and their ability to fire arrows at a rapid pace what just totally dominated us. And so until we had advances in repeating rifles and pistols, we couldn't turn the tide. And so I highly recommend that book, but it's not for the faint of heart. It is so, so brutal. So you think your life is hard. Imagine these Texas Rangers and settlers and their battles with the Comanches. That's my Texas reading. Yeah.
Yeah, no, like this podcast has had it all. We have a great article that we're posting in our show notes that talks about the office space pathology. You have a book recommendation. This is all you can ask for in a 25-minute podcast. Thank you, Congressman. Safe travels and welcome.
Thank you.
we'll take a quick break to hear from Aura. Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And I'll tell you, not only have I given this picture frame to all the moms in my life, but I'm an only child, and it's been really fun to see my friends with siblings give this frame to their moms, and it turned into a passive-aggressive war to see which siblings can upload more pictures of their children. The Aura app is so easy. You can sit there at the end of the day while you're watching TV and just upload a couple pictures from the day and really show your brother-in-law who's boss. From grandmothers to new mothers, aunts, and even the friends in your life, every mom loves an Aura frame. Named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things, Aura frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages. Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code DISPATCH at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.